handle the truth. Should we or should we not follow the advice of the galactically stupid?
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe fuck yourself.
You're all a bunch of fucking assholes. You know why? You don't have the guts to be what you want to be. You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers and say, that's the bad guy.
Clearly, don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Righteous Prick Podcast. I'm your host, J.L. Covan. It is 11:03 on the East Coast on January 18th, in the year of our Lord, 2021. I am off from work today, but I am continuing my tradition of just ate a small cup of walnuts with some cashews mixed in to cut down on the bitterness of the tree feces we call walnuts. With a cup of tea, so I'm energized. I've got good stuff running through my veins. I skipped the blueberries and eggs this morning and went right for a bowl of Raisin Bran Crunch. I figured, let me treat myself this morning to something enjoyable. Not that I don't like blueberries and eggs, but we're mixing it up. New year, new me. I'm sitting here with Cookie, who just got out of her chair and collapsed on the rug. That was enough exercise for her today. I guess she said, hey, he's talking. Oh, wait. I think she's finally getting the hang of podcasts where it's just the big angry guy talking by himself. You know, it's all about training, folks. It's all about training. That's what the dog experts say. So we're almost at the end of this this apocalyptic journey known as Trump as president. So that's a good thing, which, as I joked on my shows, and to anybody who's listening who attended one, two, or I even had somebody attend all three of my stand-up shows this past weekend. Thank you very much. I believe they were a wild success, culminating with Saturday's 80-minute show, which I got to be honest with you, folks. I know I toot my own horn a lot on this podcast with great justification. I think I delivered superb headlining sets. Like, I do everything I can to create an environment in my apartment where I feel like I'm pacing a stage so I can replicate the energy. And even the Righteous Girlfriend, who's a real naysayer on a lot of stuff comedy related. I'm just kidding. She's exceedingly supportive, but she's just not an easy laugh. She'd much rather laugh at strangers and her friends than me. I don't know why. I guess she just figures, got to keep me honest. But even she said her some of her family members were at the Saturday show or watched the Saturday show. And them and the Righteous Girlfriend were both sort of impressed with the energy and the just the quality of the stand-up performance for a Zoom show. So I try to replicate everything I can so I'm not sitting at a chair going, what else, guys? You know, this is also crazy. I just treat it like a... You know, I have a cheat sheet on the wall opposite where I perform with like 20 bullet points for the bits I want to do. And by Saturday night, by that third show, I really did deliver what was probably 90% of the level of a special that I would record. So I appreciate everybody who attended. And I will hope to have some future shows, especially, you know, not too many because I, you know, I don't want to burn everybody out because I'm at the point where 90% of the material is just going to be reworked and retooled. But I had one bit, which if I was going to sort of put out a JL's greatest hits, which I'm not going to, you know, the bits that come to mind right away as just some of the greatest things I've ever done would be 9/11 selfies on Israeli Tortoise, Millie Vanilli versus Kim Kardashian on Thoughts and Prayers, Rocky History 2.0 on Thoughts and Prayers. Honestly, Diamond Maker, the first black president, is a tremendous bit. Obviously, it's not timely anymore. In a way, it's timely because obviously he's still the first and only. He's still a major historical point, Barack Obama. But that's a great bit. You know, there's bits sprinkled out. Keep My Enemies Closer would probably comprise, you know, a third or half of a greatest hits album. If I had like 20, if I had to pick 20 tracks, I could see 7 probably coming directly from Keep My Enemies Closer, if not 10. But I did, there were a few bits, that I did, you know, like I said, about of the 80 minutes I did on Saturday, I did 70 minutes on Thursday and Friday. I think about 50 to 55 minutes of the 80-minute set is all new material since March, because I've obviously had a fairly unique journey during this time in history, and I'm also a very good comedian. So, but the bit that now seems to stand out for me, and to the person, this one woman attended all three shows, and she could already see the evolution of the bit because it went from 2 minutes to like 3 minutes to 4.5 minutes by Saturday night. It's just about holy water dispensers at my church. And it's already, I've already kind of put an asterisk next to it. I don't want to release it. It's the kind of track where I want to release it so I claim it, so people know it's mine. And because it's not, the idea of it is not so genius to start with, but the what I do with the bit, it's going to be like a Mount Rushmore bit for me, in so many ways. But it feels so good to be able to continue to come up with new material that just feels like, okay, yes, I'm continuing to meet my expectations and to meet my highest level. Like when you can do 3 or 4 bits. I have a bit on Shen Yun, I call it Chinese River Dance. There are some bits that I've developed this year that are just, they're killers. They're real killers. Like, think of my favorite bits that I've done. I still think my favorite bit of all time, and it's definitely influenced by the little work I did with Patrice O'Neill, but that was sort of, there are a few moments in my life that have shifted my comedy career to different and new levels, and I think Broken Off Engagement in 2008 is a seminal moment in my comedy career because it just, that's the moment where I went, you know, my first album was, you know, fairly family friendly and fun stuff and impressions and pop culture. And, you know, when you go through something rough in a charmed life, when you go through something rough, it just changed the tone, the tenor, the depth of my comedy because it was so shitty. And so Diamond Maker is a real shift that I continue to improve while living in that sort of space. So Diamond Maker was late 2008 release. And that set me just on a different trajectory and a different path in my comedy. But Keep My Enemies Closer, even though it was the second album I put out since working briefly with Patrice O'Neill, just 2 times. But when you work with somebody who's sort of a legend, it sticks with you. And the way he approached comedy informed, you know, if I've always said my 3 biggest influences in comedy, I think, are Greg Giraldo, Gary Gulman, and Patrice O'Neill. Just in terms of how they informed how I write and how I approach comedy. And there are some bits, there are a couple bits on this new hour that I'm working on that are very Gary Gulman inspired. Like the holy water dispenser bit is legitimately it's the kind of bit that comics Gary Gulman is almost a singular comic in this. He can do a late night set and it will be one bit. And the holy water dispenser joke is like, is that level, I think. And that was the response. The overwhelming response every night was that that was in a great set. That was the standout among a, in a strong set. That was the standout. So, you know, I'm excited. I'd like to, you know, the rest, the next month and a half for me is going to be about trying to get some representation or to get some meetings, to put together my sketch writing packet, and sort of at least a description of my new album, where it's going, to see if I can get somebody interested in producing one or both. And like I've said, if nobody bites, which won't surprise me, it'll be another disappointment, but it will not surprise me, to say the least. Then I produce them both myself, and we see the album will, you know, it'll probably be my best selling stand up album for sure, because now I have so many more people who like and are interested in my material. But I'd like to go to that next level, you know, in terms of performing, touring, so that I can, you know, make this the career after this very long, tiresome journey. I'm still, I don't know. I was just really exhausted after this weekend, but really proud of the shows I did, because, you know, if people are veteran stand-up fans, they know that I delivered the goods, Zoom or no Zoom. Like, I was crushing it, and it was silent. You know, I ask everybody to mute, but I can see people laughing and bowling over and stuff like that and giving me claps, like little signs through Zoom. But it just felt good to be like, okay, I'm still throwing fucking heat. Like, I'm not done. I haven't peaked, you know, and that's good. After six albums, you know, I'm ready for a seventh, and I know this seventh one is going to be, it's going to be at that keep my enemies closer level, which feels good, because this has always been, it's as they said in Step Brothers, they go, Derek, it's not about the money. Well, for me, it's a little bit about the money. And you know how much I made last year? $550,000. that's not how much money I made last year. I was just quoting Derek from Step Brothers. But for me, it really never has been about the money. I've always been convinced that if I got my shot and I got my respect and I got the opportunities, money would come. Some level of fame would come because I know my skills. But it's never about that. Like, it just never has been. It's never like, and this sort of brings me into a few things that I've noticed. I'll get to that in a little bit. But I just want to say thank you to everybody who attended the shows. And if you didn't go to a show this weekend, I'm probably going to do like a weekend afternoon show at some point, because I had many European fans saying that they, you know, it was like, I can't do like a 3 a.m. show, which is totally understandable. So I might want to just do one that you know, that's amenable to some of my international fans, Mr. Worldwide. So there might be another one in February. But the goal is to get all my writing down and start making some presentations to people, try to get some representation so that I can hit the ground running in like April or May. As soon as I get vaccinated and all that shit, I want to headline clubs. I want to put one of these on either video, audio, or both. You know, it's, you know, just based on it, I need, like, I can tell you right now, I need a month. I think I need a month of gigs before I'm ready to record. So that's a very Operation Warp Speed timeline for an album. But the truth is, as many of you already know, all my albums until this point were done as a feature act, where I'm stitching together the sets, trying to. I never got to rehearse one of my albums as a full set before doing the set for the album. Like, I just had to stitch it together and piecemeal. Like, I'm going to do these 20 minutes. I'm going to do these 8 minutes. I'm going to do this 20 minutes. I'm going to do this 15 minutes. And I'm going to do as many of it as I can and work on the bits that I don't know as well, or that I really need to just iron out some details. But the idea of me getting a month to just do long sets, to do some clubs that'll headline me, man, if I get to actually do an album the way other comedians sometimes get to do albums, just think, if you're a fan of mine, Keep My Enemies Closer, Thoughts and Prayers, those were one take. Like, that's it. That was one take. I had never done the full set in my life until the recording of those albums. So
you know, imagine what I can do. Like, as I've joked with other people, I'm still at that 1930s pro baseball player level where it's like, well, when the season's done, I deliver milk to the community because I get paid $18 a game in the major leagues. That's like where my career is. So if I can ever go full-time, be a, you know, a full-time player, you know, that the sky's the limit. I've never even gotten to sort of record an album in a traditional sense of, all right, my album is recording June 2nd. I've got 13 weeks of headlining work until then to iron everything out. I've never had that. So if I can have that even over a month, if I could just book like four clubs that work me consistently, I'm gonna cry. And then the luxury of being able to do like four sets and record four sets or something at like Helium or somewhere that I enjoy performing. You know, this is, I think there's no doubt that the new album, whatever I end up calling it, whatever I end up titling it, could probably be my best just because of all the opportunities to really make it perfect. So I'm looking forward to that. So my next 6 weeks is going to be about seeing if I can get people interested. I don't know really why I haven't yet, but get people interested. Get one person. I just need one person to give me a shot. And you know, then hopefully 2020. You know, 2020 was like my arrival finally, but 2021 hopefully is when the career can become a reality. But yeah, the Holy Water dispenser bit. Man, like, God, it's so good. It's so, so good. And I'm so tempted to put out a rough draft of it just to make sure that it doesn't get claimed. Like, nobody's going to do it as well. But a good example of what I'll give you two examples of more famous people doing bits of mine that I didn't think were as good. But then it becomes like, oh, didn't so-and-so do that? One was when I was in DC in my first year, the first big bit I had of my career probably was I was doing an Arnold Schwarzenegger impression and it was as hacky and annoying. It was a good impression. I've seen a much better one on TikTok, but it was a really good impression. It was an A-. Okay. That's sort of my threshold. I don't like to do anything. I try not to do impressions below an A- unless I put a disclaimer, like my Ben Carson impression. I was like, this is not good. I'm just doing this for fun. I just feel like comedic integrity, I have to do that. I don't really want to do B+ or worse impressions if I can help it, at least in my opinion. Maybe somebody else will think it sucks, but I don't want to do one that I think is just okay just to do it, which is why I haven't done a Joe Biden. Come on, man. Like, that's, anybody can do that, right? Jack? But my son, Bo, he won a sucker. He was a patriot. You know, it's like I feel like anybody can do that. I don't think I'm striking any unique chord. Like, if you gave my Joe Biden a B or a B-, I'd be like, then it's not worth doing. That's my approach. But, brain fart one of the show. Impressions. Oh yeah, so I'm at the DC Improv and I've been doing it open mics and comedians sort of knew it as my bit at Arnold Schwarzenegger family reunion. And this is when I knew a very easy lesson. First off, I'd be like, before you do this bit, you better talk about how you're half black. This is going back to 2003, my first year in comedy, 2003 to 2004. And I remember watching the bit back in like in 07. So just a few years later, and I was already just embarrassed, not by the content, but just like what a hack I was. But people laughed, and that should have been a lesson to me that people love hacks. Comedians don't love hacks. Good comedy fans don't love hacks, but the average person loves a hack. And I'm up there going like, what if Owen Wilson were Joe? This was an early bit. What if Owen Wilson, don't you think if they made a movie about a sequel to Passion of the Christ, or something, or a reboot of Passion of the Christ, because that had come out in like 03, I want to say, 03, 02 or 03. I said, wouldn't you have somebody like Owen Wilson as Joseph? And then I would just go, I was like, Mary, how you're telling me that's God's kid? How am I supposed to compete with that? And that was a big winner for me, and I'm obviously super rusty with my Owen Wilson. So, Mary, they tell me you're pregnant, Mary. You're pregnant, right? Well, you know, I wasn't even here, Mary. I wasn't even here. You're telling me that's God's kid?
How am I supposed to compete with that? He's huge. That was the bit.
It feels good. I guess I'm one of those people who likes hacks. But, yeah, so that was one of the bits. And the other one was an Arnold Schwarzenegger family reunion. And it was me talking to Arnold and abbreviating his name to where it sounded eerily like a slur. You know, I'm like, Schwarzenegger, that's such a long name. And it was like this bit where, with me going, get over here, you, get over here, you lazy ass nigga. Don't you want to be strong like your Uncle Anna, not like your, not a lazy ass nigga like Uncle Frank. And, it got tons of laughs from, and I learned that, you know, I had to preface my, you know, it's towing a line clearly. And I had to preface it with, you know, and by the way, my dad's black, everybody. This bit, me introducing my, racial lineage, will be very important context in a couple of minutes. But it was hacky. It was lame, but it got a lot of laughs because I was good at the impressions. And then Dave Chappelle came out with a bit called the Nigger Family. He was like, what if a family of white people were named Nigger? Well, let's see what it is. And that's what, that was the bit. And I got texts. I remember that night when it aired on Chappelle's show, I got texts from three different comedians in DC saying, oh man, you see Chappelle's show? Sorry, man. Because there was an acknowledgement like, oh, your bit is just going to seem like a ripoff now. It isn't. We're acknowledging it isn't, but it's going to feel like that because now 800 people have seen your Schwarzenegger family reunion. A million have seen the Dave Chappelle sketch. So you're out of luck now. And I was like, damn. Okay, so that was the first time. And then Michael Che did a bit on his like 2015, I want to say maybe 2016. When he had a Netflix special several years ago, it was either like 2015 or 2016, I think. And he did a bit, a very kind of just a, almost like a 30-second little snippet. But he was talking about like maybe dads just don't want their kids getting fucked. Like in terms of like parents not wanting their kid, like their sons to be gay. You know, the concept, I have an entire bit on Keep My Enemies Closer where the joke is maybe fathers are just angry relative to how much their kid is getting drilled. And I go piece by piece. I'm like, you know, straight son, no problem. Unless you raise a piece of shit and then that straight son can go to jail and he might get a lot of dick. So that will be bad. You know, then I'm like, gay daughter, next level. See, she's a daughter. It's not sexist, but she's getting no dick. The father's totally fine. Then you get to straight daughter and you're like trying to find the, you got to be a good father, but not too good and not too bad because then she might get a ton of dicks. And then last but not least, certainly is gay son and they're going to get the most dick. And that might be what stresses out a father. And I joked saying that's why all homophobic dads or dads who are scared of their sons getting plowed should be pro-gay marriage because what better way to reduce the amount of fucking your kid will do than to let them get married? So, it was my bit was like a 4 minute intricate, 3 or 4 minute intricate bit where I hit up details of each layer. And Che's was like 30 seconds, like a throwaway, like, eh, and then on to the next bit. Now mine predated his by 2 or 3 years and I'm not claiming any, there's no claim here of theft on either case. But it just becomes frustrating when you're like, oh, that person did like that more famous person did a bit that isn't even like mine, but mine to the person who doesn't know my career well might think that I just sort of pulled a Jay-Z and like used their lyric or bit as a starting point for mine, which I, of course, didn't. All that to say, the holy water bit is so good, but I also don't want to reveal it. It's like it's a catch 22 where it's like if I reveal it, people will laugh and I'll have evidence that I did it first. But if I don't reveal it, if I don't share it with the world and I do get it on an album or a special, it could be a legitimate, huge viral sort of stand up clip. It's just so good. So I, you know, but that my, you know, it was a great weekend of shows. I was stressed the whole weekend because I, you know, I just get stressed with comedy because I give a shit. I want every time I'm writing a sketch for, you know, those, not now, I don't write any shit now, but when I was writing the sketches for like, you know, 2010 to 2018, when I had my little crew of comedians doing my sketch shows and sketch bits, I got stressed. I couldn't sleep before the night because I just felt like every sketch mattered because I don't know. Maybe this will be the one that goes viral. Maybe this will be the one that people see. This is my work, so I want it to be the best it can be. So I don't know. I thank you, everybody, for showing up. That's the point of that long preamble. But, of course, a week can't go by without me being frustrated and insulted by the comedy world. And this week it was the Howard Stern Show contacted me again, which I was like, oh, look at that. Now, just as a catch me up, I appeared three times on the Howard Stern. Two of the three appearances were sort of legendary level, you know, when I'm getting producers writing to me going, 20 minutes, holy shit, he never stays on with impersonators that long. That was amazing. The response to my appearances was universally fantastic. The third appearance I did was when Stern was getting a lot of heat and beef from Donald Trump Jr., who had like exposed that he had done blackface in the 90s, and I don't know if there was other dirt being dug up. But all of a sudden, my appearance was 5 minutes. It was cut short because they had other things to do, and I was never asked on again. I had a couple of writing sessions with their writers, more for Howard's like comfort, because I was always like, you can talk about whatever. I'm that legit with this shit, both on an impression and comedy quickness level. But if you want to do writing sessions or bullet points for him to feel like he's hitting it up, great, whatever, you're the boss. I'm getting my couple hundred to appear on this shit, so we'll do what you say. They never so I did two writing sessions, obviously never got paid for those, never got, you know, you're helping the paid people write, and then they canceled me twice and then never contacted me again. But they started using a different guy who does a lot of makeup and hair really well for the Trump impression and has had a lot of success with it, but he's basically sort of a hacky cartoon character version of Trump in terms of the quality of the impression. But I don't say that to insult the man, even though I know that is insulting, but it's a cartoon, goofy, and certainly on an audio level, it ain't close. So like for a radio show to pivot to an actor voice person, an actor YouTuber, instead of me, after I'm crushing it, and my hypothesis, which was sort of confirmed, was that they didn't want somebody who, you know, they wanted it more controlled. And I wasn't cursing, I wasn't saying, but I had full command of all the politics, all the current events, all the where all the bodies are buried with Trump, and could just go quick, boom, boom, boom. There was no, you know, I was going to come into an interview like Trump. Not like an actor being paid to play Trump, but I was going to bring all the shock and awe of a Trump impersonator. And the response from fans for my first couple of appearances was great. So it hurt. I was sort of personally offended that they were going to a clearly lesser quality, just to be fair, a lower quality audio impression, because it's radio. This guy does like all the accoutrement of Trump much better than me, except for the comedy content and the voice. And for a radio show, you'd think that would be the thing. And as I've complained before, I'm like, of all the times for Howard Stern to possibly chicken out of a fight, of course it had to be when my career was benefiting from it. But whatever, what can you do? Who gives a shit, right? Water on the bridge. So I forgot about it. I said I got other things to do. You know, Trump is a bullet point in my career. It's a big bullet point, but I, as you know, I want to get doing a sketch show. I want to do a stand-up hour. I want to headline. Those are my goals. But I get this email from Howard Stern's show producer. No, how are you? Like, you got to remember, this has been like 5 months since I was summarily dismissed without anything else other than just like, oh, we're not going to use you. And then I'm finding out they're using somebody else. And there's just no respect for what I do. And that, whatever, I was over it. I was like, whatever, like, it's okay, good. Like I've been disrespected by multiple big outfits this year. That's part of the business. It hurts and it angers me because sometimes you'd rather be left alone than have somebody jerk you off and then tell you no. You know, Jimmy Fallon, Conan, you'd rather have people just not contact you rather than, hey, we'd love to use you for a segment. Could you record this? Could you re-record this? Could you? And then you go, oh, it's been canceled. Thanks for the help. I remember saying that to the person at Conan. They didn't get my sarcasm, but I was like, always happy to help. But I was like, I'm a comedian. I'm trying to make this my business. Like, I'm not here to help. I'm here to work. Okay. And I never liked that they
termed it thanks for helping us out. Like, it felt so condescending. Obviously, the New Year's Eve thing was whatever. That's the break. But I was like, I wish they just hadn't contacted me. But, you know, I played along. I was going to do my testing, all this COVID testing. And then they were like, a day before the COVID test, we're like, we've cut the segment. Sorry. Thanks for helping. I was like, whatever. Par for the course. That's what happens. That's why I just want to do, I'd like to do my own stuff. You know, there's security in that. You know, just like owning all my albums, there's security in saying, yeah, I put out albums, I tour as a comedian and build my name up, and then people will come to you and show you respect. But right now, they still treat you like you need to be grateful they're talking to you. And because there's no deeper respect for my career or my talent, it's just like, you're a Trump guy. We'd like to use you if it works for us. And that, I get it. That's the business. But the Stern people contact me. There's no, hey, how are you? Hey, long time, or hope you're doing well. It was just like, hey, JL, can you record this song? Can you record this song for us, please, and get it back to us? Here's a sample. The lyrics are below. Thanks. And the song was a We Are the World parody. And I assume it was going to be done by multiple Trump impersonators. Because obviously, if I'm not their go-to guy anymore, they're going to offer this to their go-to guy as well. But of course, they want my voice because I'm good at the voice. And they can, and maybe that's what they want. The lyrics of the song were an entire bashing of what losers Trump impersonators are. It was like, our careers are in the shitter, we're on Cameo, we're pathetic, holy fuck, we'll do impressions for food. And I was like, I get the humor behind it, but let your boy do that. Let your boy that you decided was safer. Like, you don't get to disrespect my career and my talent and my time, and then without so much as a hello or how you been, ask me to do something where I'm the butt of a joke. Like, I want to escape the Trump shit. I'm okay to still do it. But like, unlike many of these other Trump impersonators, I have a body of work from impressions to TV credits to albums that is bigger than that. Now, if I was their guy, if they had shown me respect throughout the year and made me their guy and continued to use me, I'd be much more amenable to that. I can see the joke there. But you don't get to, you contact me with no pleasantries and just think, what? You're Howard Stern, so I'm going to fucking shit on myself so you can have a 2-minute bit. It was like a We Are the World parody. It's not that it wasn't funny, but it was like, the disconnect, the depth of disrespect. Now, your ass is presumably afraid of Don Jr. dumping whatever 80s and 90s skeletons you have in your closet out for everybody. So you backed off there, but you have no problem. Your staff has no problem trying to use me to like shit on myself. No. So, I talked to a friend at the show who was like, hey, you know, I totally get where you're coming from, but like, hey, you know, this doesn't mean you're done with the show. Like, if you have other characters or other things, and in my head, I was like, I am done with the show. Like, I am. Like, I don't let anybody disrespect my fucking career. I'll fucking drown my comedy career in a bathtub before I let anybody disrespect it. Because what's the phrase from the Bible? What good, you know, that they've used for Trump so often about the Republicans? You know, what good is it to gain the whole world and lose your soul? I don't give a fuck. Like, first of all, it's not like Stern did anything for me in terms of expanding my reach. Like, I got like 2 Michael Rappaport tweets. That's cool. But like, beyond that, What did you give to, like, most of the people who heard me on Stern already were following me. And it's just one of those things where I'm like, I'm going to let you disrespect me for what? I won't let anybody disrespect my comedy for anything, but I'm certainly not going to let somebody do it for nothing. so that's, I am done with the show. Like, I have no, like, The disconnect, the idea, like, it let me know what they think of me. And, you know, it's just, it ain't going to happen. I'm not going to join the show. If I could get the greatest fucking Joe Biden impression in the world, I'll take it somewhere else. I won't. by the way. I know that I can't really do a Biden, but I'll take that shit somewhere else. I don't need to lend my skills to a show that blatantly disrespected me, but didn't have the guts to use me. You know what I mean? Like that's maybe that's just a perfect encapsulation of that show. I don't know. I know it's got a lot of fans. I know he's a good interviewer, but the fact is, I don't give a fuck that I'm a nobody. In fact, that's even worse. It's even worse that they show disrespect to a nobody who doesn't have the clout to sort of make a big deal of it. But they'll show deference to Don Jr. if they're afraid too much dirt will come out, right? And that's a hypothesis. I'm not stating a fact right there, but that is my theory in terms of the timing of what happened to my appearances on the show. So the lesson is, when you've been a struggling stand-up comedian who for most of your career could only take pride in the content you created and not the wealth you had accumulated, disrespect is just it's the red line I will not let people cross. I will not allow people to waste my time or insult my work and then work with them. That's just will not happen. So you know, that it seems like every couple of weeks something happens in my comedy career that enrages me, and that really enraged me. You know, but whatever. It's the nature of the business, I guess, that there's people. But it just seems so weird to disrespect a relative nobody and then just try to get me to shit on myself. Like, why don't you just go do fucking bum fights, Stern Show? Just do that. Go fucking pay money to bums and film it and interview them on the show. Like what? Like, I know that's a stretch from what I'm talking about, but it's like, you know, I'm not here for to debase myself. And working with that show, I would consider a debasement to myself, because they have let me know what they think of me, that I am good enough to be. I'm good enough to be on the show, but not good enough to put Howard Stern at jeopardy of mean tweets from Don Jr. So that was fun. I wonder if that's enough. That's enough, I guess. I was told, a friend of mine was like, "Don't tweet out about this," and I was like, "Nah, I'll put it on the podcast because, you know, It's one of those things where I go, I'm not insulting anybody on the show. They disrespected me. Plain and simple. That's just a fact. They don't care enough to realize it's disrespect, which is just sort of compounding the disrespect. But that's a fact. That's not me being like, fuck them, they're assholes, they're fuck. No, it's just they disrespected me. I will not work with that show. But it's just disheartening that keeps happening, because it's like, Just leave, you know. I just want people who want to. If nobody wants to work with me, that's cool. But if somebody wants to work with me, then work with me. Like, you know, show me the as Sherrod Brown would say, the dignity of work. and then I just see, it's funny to me also to see as this Trump shit winds down. You know, like I see the Lincoln Project. They fucking got like a, what do you call it? They got like some deal with like not William Morris, but ICM, like International Creative Manager, one of the major platforms to do like podcasts and content. And I see that, and I see these guys like the Midas Touch guys who've made some good videos, and like they were using this terrible Trump impersonator, and they've like retweeted my stuff, and I just realized that this year has been a blessing for me, but it portends some really bad. Because we've talked about the decline of expertise, like that's a common theme among like liberal elites and educated people of like, you know, expertise from science to everything else is like diminished now. It's like if you don't want to hear it, you can find somebody who can tell you what you want to hear. Like, you know, just look at COVID and you'll see the diminishment of expertise and the disregard of experts and knowledge now. It's like not expertise is like optional now for things. But I see that with comedy too, that people will like it's now about the clicks only. And you see even these like political entities who want to become brands now.
They figure it's not what's, it's less important that you have the best guy doing X, Y, or Z. It's about that you have the most people watching X, Y, and Z. And if you can get somebody cheaper, or you've got the clicks, or you make yourself the brand, like a lot of these groups, I think they think they're like amateur filmmakers now. My favorite is this guy, and I have a few books by him, Don Winslow, who just, it's so funny for me to see that like my clicks have gone down. And I realize one of the keys to Twitter is like, they encourage you to stay focused. Like if I had made my entire account anti-Trump tweets and anti-Trump videos, and that's all, I think the algorithm would have continued to be like, people like this, amplify this. But as I started to do, here's some stand-up clips, here's some serious commentary, here's some jokes that have nothing to do with this or that, you see the platform starts to minimize your exposure. It always takes like, now for me to get a video to blow up, I need like two of the people who follow me to see it, and to be like huge accounts, like a Rex Chapman to amplify the account. That kind of person needs to amplify it, even though I have a lot of followers. And I've lost 100 followers a day for, now I'm back to this shit, 100 followers a day for 17 consecutive days. So it's like I'm not replenishing the bots that are disappearing because I'm not getting any more exposure than the minimum, it seems, for whatever reason. But I think part of that was I didn't play the consistency game. I didn't go, my account for the next 8 months will be dedicated to anti. Like I see there's this chick from Jersey. I don't know her name. Her entire account is like B+ Trump directed snark. And she's like blowing up. And it's like, yeah, that's her entire page. I don't know if she's a bot or a real person, but it's like Twitter seems to just encourage like you to do the same thing. If the algorithm decides that you are a Trump video person, then once you start deviating from that, you will start to slip and then you won't get it back. That seems to be what happened to my page. But I see a lot of these guys just, you know, but Winslow is the funniest because he's been making these like high-end like Twitter videos with his production company. I'm always laughing because it's the most basic shit. He's like, Donald Trump is a menace. Fuck him and his people. 408,000 likes. And it's like these videos, it's like, we need 10,000 retweets this hour. And in my head, I'm like, why? Why are there so many old men with wealth and careers who are like talking about how they need retweets? It's like the only thing, it's such a weird thing to me because it becomes, oh, wow, you've got to see this Don Winslow video. Everybody who already agrees with me. It's so bizarre to me. And I loved it when he posted this one, which was like, I guess once Trump lost and everything, he wrote Mitch McConnell, like he added Mitch McConnell and was like, Mitch McConnell, I'm coming for you next. And it was like, Mitch McConnell, I almost trolled him and was going to be like, dude, I agree with you politically mostly, but Mitch McConnell ain't reading this tweet. But you had everybody else getting their popcorn gifts out going like, I'm here for it, Don. Woo, this is going to be killer. And I was like, this is weird. And this is somebody who elevated themselves on Trump. Okay. But the truth is, I've tried to keep my account the same as it was before I blew up, which is here's some stand-up, here's some serious commentary, here's an impression. Yes, most of them have been Trump because it's a signature bit of mine. But I've done, as I showed a few weeks ago, I put together a highlight reel of me doing like 18 impressions just on Twitter in 2020, you know, like in the videos and in different videos from Chappelle to McConnell to Cory Booker, Dennis Rodman. Like, you know, I put those almost to say, like, I know you all know me for Trump, but like, these are the other impressions you've seen while watching these videos. But many people don't see the videos because the algorithm is no longer my friend. So that's also fun. But it's just so weird to see, you know, conservatives decry the experts of, you know, science and things like, you don't know what you don't have all the answers, and my QAnon people can have their own scientific beliefs. But on the left, what I've just noticed, and I notice obviously because I'm self-interested in this capacity, is like, yeah, they just, these places don't want to, it's like, it becomes about your brand. Like, in other words, why use a great Trump impersonator? That might take credit away from us. Let's just use amateurs and kids and students and bad impersonators, because our content will go viral anyway, but then the focus remains on our brand that we're building. And I just, to me, it's so funny to be like, the best Trump impersonator and a big comedian is the only, like, if you lip sync Trump, you have an agent and a manager and a huge career. If you made videos bashing Trump, even if you were political operatives who helped create the modern GOP, you get entertainment content deals with major agencies. If you are just some people who decided, yeah, we work in literature or commercial work, but we decided to dedicate ourselves to anti-Trump content, you get Sirius XM shows or a million followers on Twitter. But and it becomes, but if you're the impersonator who does the best Trump content and has created 12 hours of original material in 1 year, you just get suppressed by the algorithm and no representation. And that's my point, is that it's a weird world now. I know that's self-serving, but I would say this if it wasn't happening to me, because it's bizarre to see that the best comedy content is like somehow not the most desired content for a lot of people. It seems like having an infrastructure and being like having fame and having like clout, I don't really understand it, because what I see is a lot of repetitive self-patting on the back content. Like, the thing I'm most proud of this year, I'm obviously a very big anti-Trump person, but what I'm proud of is, yes, every week I'll probably post one or two or three serious comments that will get a lot of retweets or likes, because it's playing into the algorithm, what the algorithm wants from me, I guess. But what I'm most proud of is that, unlike all these other people who couldn't seem to use their abilities and talents to bash Trump, I bash Trump through what I do. I'm a comedian. I made comedy videos shitting on Trump with original content, and it was a seamless sort of marriage between me showing off my comedy and impression chops and bashing Trump. But I didn't need to just turn my page into some sort of serious diatribe every day and separate that and be like, I'm also a comedian. No, it's like, you can see I'm a comedian because I'm putting up all this comedy content. But it's so weird to see all these other people just shift into, you know, and it's all for likes and deals. And you're just, it's so weird to me. It's such a, and it's just another harbinger of doom, I guess. Like, I remember trying to get on Sirius XM, get a weekly show as Trump way back in like 2016. Like, I did an election day show as Trump with the help of Aaron Hodges. And the best they would ever do for me during the entire Trump presidency was, oh, we might be able to give you like a guest spot, like a 1 hour off, like special show on election day or primary day. And I was like, okay, I guess I'll take it. But it was so I just found it so bizarre that like the Midas Touch brothers, who've made like a lot of great content and built up a big following, they got like a weekly show on Sirius. And I'm like, but they're pretty political. And, you know, sometimes I think somebody had said the fact that I fooled so many callers into thinking they were speaking with the president. Once again, I would think that would be hilarious and great, you know? Orson Welles became partly famous, not just for Citizen Kane, but for his reading of War of the Worlds, that like many people thought we were actually being invaded by aliens. Like, I don't see how fooling people into thinking they're talking to Trump on a comedy show is bad content. But it was, you got the old, it's political. But then it's like, no, I guess it's me, because you're literally giving shows to political operatives and ad makers. So I don't get what my lesson was from this whole year. I guess the lesson was, be grateful that your Trump impression made you a good amount of money in 2020, and then try your darndest to pivot away from that, because it's not a conducive space that represents or recognizes comedy well. It recognizes clout and viral, and the people who can trigger that the best or who are thirsty and desperate enough to be like, I'm an author worth $30 million, but I need 10,000 retweets right now. And people are just like, yes, go get them. It's like, he's not getting anybody. It's just weird. So I just, you know, man, I just, I, 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 I don't know, other than sounding like Sherrod Brown now by the end of when I've talked a lot. I don't know where this goes. But obviously you know my comedy plans, and let's all take a moment to hope that that my career has a good moment headed its way. So we'll see. But yeah, that was my week. And I can't, you know, oh man, the outrage machine is not just one way. It's less unethical from left, I think. Like now these guys are going to be like, we're going after Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley. And it's like, good, I guess, go get them. But I don't know if that'll do anything. And what do you do after that? Like, it's, you know, we need good governance and we need good policy and we need people encouraging and educating on policy and things like that. That's what we need. We don't need 8 outfits competing to be viral just to like own a senator who never reads your tweets. That's why I think Lauren Boebert, or whatever the fuck her last name is, the cute little QAnon psycho chick. That's what, like, the left, I think, needs her more than the right does, to be honest, because they can keep having a villain to, like, just bombard you with on Twitter. And not in, like, a fun, like, that's the thing. That's my point. I know I put out a lot of Trump content, but, like, 93% of it was comedy, you know, that people laughed at, not just like, this is great and powerful. Because I know that I'm at some point I'm kind of preaching to the choir. So I just want to make people laugh because that's what I'm here for. I'm not running for office and I'm not trying to be a super PAC. But it's I'm glad that the Trump era is over for so many reasons. It made so many people stupid when it came to comedy. It's like, I think I'll enable the podcast, like, trust the comedy experts. You know what I mean? Because I just feel like, you know, it's so weird. Like, the comedy is becoming this fault line. And I'm trying to thread a needle to find the people who are like center left or center right, but who like good comedy and aren't, you know, there's an increasing group in comedy of like kind of right wing where it's like, you're going to cover all your hate speech and stupidity. Even if you're a good comedian, you're going to cover all your hate speech and stupidity under some like broader, we're just about liberty and freedom. Like, and it's like, shut the fuck up. And then the left, as I've been exposed to, becomes saying this as somebody who's benefited from some of this, it becomes it really is like an echo chamber. And where it becomes a green clapter, you know, it's more important to get claps than laughs sometimes. And I'm not down with that shit either at all. Both sides can be guilty of the clapter. Like whenever you get like a Dave Chappelle talking about like the left is ruining comedy, you know, they'll clap. That's not a laugh line, but you'll have a lot of his fans clapping. Just like as I talked about when he did his Broadway show and I went to see it and I wrote about it. It's in my JL Central Reader tab on my blog. But when Chappelle made such a stupid false equivalency, like it would have failed the SAT analogy test. But he did this thing where he goes, they wouldn't let me say, hey, they wouldn't let me say the F word, but they'd let me say the N word. And it was like, you don't see the difference. Like, and the crowd, his crowd was so down with that point. And I was like, that's not the same thing. I guarantee you they would let a gay comedian say the F word, but they would not let a gay white comedian say the N word. They would say that goes against our standards and practices. That's the analogy. The analogy is, are they letting a gay comedian say the N word? Well, then they should allow the black straight comedian to say the F word. But that's not what they were doing. But Chappelle made, like, there was such a thirst in his crowd, you know, to be allowed to say, yeah, like, pardon my language, but to say, oh, why can't I say faggot? It's not the same as the N-word. And in my mind, it always has been. It always has been. I shouldn't say it always has been. Once I became a fucking educated adult, I realized how hateful that word is. I said it in high school without a question, but I'm not a fucking high schooler anymore. I grew up. I went to college, I got educated, and whenever somebody says it in my presence, I tell them, dude, don't say, I need you to not drop the F word. It's a slur. And, you know, it's always somebody who's like, it's not the same. It's not the same. I'm like, who are you to determine? People have been murdered in this country while the assailants use that word. So it's not your place. That's not being too PC. It's a slur. But I could see in Chappelle's crowd, he got a lot of claps for that. Like, speak some truth. It was black men. It was white men. It was that, maybe it was some women too, but it was that, like, yes, preach, clapter, because we're about free speech here. And it was like, you got to be some kind of fucking stupid to make that point. And that's what I say with Chappelle. Whenever somebody wants to ask me, who's your favorite, you know, Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle, I'll go, I'll take the one who didn't say, I'm going to give Trump a chance. Because he may be a talented comedian, but we got to stop acting like a dude speaking seriously into a microphone for 20 minutes about how his agent fucked him out of money with his Comedy Central show. We can't just treat that dude like a genius just because he speaks seriously sometimes and makes us laugh. And you know, so I'm always going to be a Chris Rock person just because Bring the Pain is still my favorite special ever. But the tiebreaker, if it was even a tie, would be who is the one who didn't go on SNL and say, I'm going to give Trump a chance. And who's the one who didn't try to equate a black man using the F word to a black man using the N word? Who's the one who failed SAT analogies? I'm going to not go with that one. So that's how, I don't know. There is some clapter on both sides, but it seems to be much more progressive driven, the sort of like, I agree with this, therefore I am calling it good comedy. I would love to escape this space. And the best way to do that would be if I can create a stand-up comedy special and or a sketch comedy show that features very little political comedy and very little Trump, and then build a new fan base if I can get that exposure. You know, keep the fans who have appreciated my body of work. You know, they can, obviously most came for the Trump, but a lot have stayed for the other stuff. But on top of that, it's also, it would just be nice to, like, you know, oh, in 2022, I picked up 200,000 fans and 190,000 of them were because they loved my stand-up special. And then you don't have to worry about any of this other bullshit. So, like, this is the work of my year is going to be converting and expanding fans of my other work. And unfortunately, when you're not on Facebook, because I quit Facebook a few years ago because it's terrible, you know, I'm reliant on Twitter algorithms to a certain extent. But an HBO special or a Netflix special is not reliant on shit. Once people see that, they will find you, hopefully. So I don't know. That's how about that for a righteous prick Martin Luther King Jr. holiday episode? A lot of thought, a lot of bitterness, but hopefully, you know, just another glimpse into what the fuck is going on in my mind and how I hope my career can progress from here. So thank you for listening, folks. Appreciate it as always. If you haven't already, please give it a 5-star review on iTunes, also known as Apple Podcasts. And I guess that's it. I watched Mank this weekend. I'm a huge David Fincher fan. Huge. My favorite contemporary director. Probably in my, you know, Mount Rushmore of directors, I think what he's done. Even from Alien 3, I thought was so slick. But 7 is such a phenomenal movie. Social Network. What a great movie. Great filmmaker. But Mank, I just wasn't into it. I actually enjoyed Citizen Kane more than I enjoyed Mank, which is weird. Obviously, nobody's going to call Mank the greatest movie of all time the way they do Citizen Kane. But, you know, Mank is made in 2020 versus Citizen Kane, which was made in, I believe, 1942 or 41. But the point being, his father, Fincher's father, wrote the script, and it's been like a passion project of his for a long time to make it. And he made it, and it kind of evokes, it's almost done like Citizen Kane. There's so much Citizen Kane camera work and an old-timey feel to the movie and done through many flashbacks that I assume the point was, we're going to tell the story of Citizen Kane getting made using Citizen Kane's cinematic techniques pioneered by Orson Welles. And already people have sort of a little bit debunked the idea that, like, Orson Welles had nothing to do with writing the movie and just kind of got a co-writing credit because. But obviously it seems that Mankiewicz did do the bulk, if not the enormous lion's share of the writing. who knows about the history. Just speaking on the movie, I think it's my least favorite David Fincher movie. So let that be a lesson to you. Don't make your dad's scripts. And his father passed away, so I'm sure it meant a lot to him. And he's a great filmmaker, but I just, man, I love so many David Fincher movies. I think I own at least three on Blu-ray, but I just was not, for whatever reason, I was not feeling Mank. But I wanted to watch it because I'm a David Fincher fan and it's an Oscar contender. But the next two movies I'm going to watch are both on Amazon Prime, so maybe I can report on those next week's episode. But Sound of Metal with Riz Ahmed, I'd been tempted to watch it, and then I saw that he was like, it's basically, he's like co-front runner for best actor for all the awards with Chadwick Boseman, which I'm happy to see Chadwick Boseman getting the lead actor. I was just afraid they'd do that supporting actor shit, and I was like, he's not the supporting actor. There's no way. And of course, he is getting all the lead acting nominations, which is good. I was just afraid they'd do some of that award show gamesmanship. But apparently Riz Ahmed has already beaten him in one or two award shows for Sound of Metal. So my next two are Sound of Metal and A Night in Miami, both on Amazon Prime, both Oscar award contenders. So hopefully I enjoy them more than Mank. And certainly I sound like the fans I don't like, where I'm like, David Fincher, I love your work. I did not like Mank. But, you know, for me, David Fincher, you're like, you know, 10 for 11 now. That's still pretty good. That's the other thing I always like. Like when I asked the Righteous Girlfriend, like, oh, what'd your family think? Like a couple cousins and her sister and brother watched the Saturday show. And they were very impressed and complimentary. But I always love it when you never get this at a concert. Like when somebody says, How was the Guns N' Roses concert? My answer is awesome. My answer is not, I liked November Rain. Because if you hear that, you'd be like, wait, I did like 20 other songs. You're just singling out one song. But when you do a comedy show, you're like killing for 80 minutes. And then they like, everybody always goes, I liked the Holy Water bit. Or I really enjoyed the P90X comedy bit. And I'm like, damn, that's it? They like, I always enjoy the great show compliments and never the ones where somebody picks out like one joke. The worst is when I do live shows and I've done like a half hour killer set and they come out and they go, I loved the Adam Sandler joke. And you're like, that Adam Sandler joke is a 15 second comment on how I look like Adam Sandler. That's what you liked? Get out of my fucking face with that terrible compliment that makes me lose all respect for you as somebody with a brain and who came to a comedy show. But anyway, that's it for this week, guys. Enjoy your day off. Enjoy your holiday. And, you know, back at it for another week. We wish Joe Biden the best of luck. I wish for a return to normalcy. I want to get a COVID vaccine. I want to do some shows. I want to get an album out. I want to record a sketch comedy hour. I want to move past Trump. I want Trump to be the Walter White of my career. It may be the biggest year of my career, but it doesn't mean my career is over. And it doesn't mean I can't expand and do other things. Right, Bryan Cranston, listener of the show? Just kidding. He's never heard of me. So thank you, everybody, for listening. I know this was another up and down episode, but, you know, this is what this podcast is like on a 3-week rotation between deep insight into comedy, deep insight into life, hilarious mania, repeat. So this was, I think, a deep insight into comedy episode. So thank you to everybody except the Howard Stern Show. And I will see you next Tuesday.